It is a truly, it's just a wild contrast when you really stop and think about it.
Oh, absolutely. It's fascinating.
Right. Because on one hand, you have these legendary, almost, I don't know, mythical stories of people trekking out into the woods, taking these massive reality-bending heroic doses of mushrooms and coming back completely changed forever.
Yeah, the classic psychedelic narrative.
Exactly. But then on the exact same spectrum, you've got people casually popping tiny microdoses with their morning coffee, like right before their commute to the
You're
office.
treating it like a daily vitamin.
Yeah, you are looking at the exact same substance, but it's being used in ways that seem entirely contradictory.
It really is a fascinating dichotomy. I mean, for a very long time, that vast space between the heroic dose and the microdose was filled with, well, with nothing but underground folklore,
Just
basically.
anecdotal reports, right?
Exactly. We had people's personal stories, sure, but we had absolutely no clinical map of what was actually happening to human consciousness.
And that's exactly what we're doing today. We are cutting straight through that folklore. We're going on a deep dive into some landmark data from places like Johns Hopkins, NYU, Imperial College
Kind of
London,
hitters.
right? The heavy hitters. And this was all recently compiled in a massive breakdown from the OTW Journal called Micro to Macro.
And what these researchers found, it completely rewrites the rules of how this substance works.
It really does. So, for you listening, our mission today is to look at the hard clinical science of psilocybin dosing protocols. But, where do we even begin with a landscape this broad?
Well, I think we have to begin by acknowledging a massive paradigm shift that happened recently in the scientific community. Because for decades, the data we had on dosing was just purely guesswork.
Like self-reported trips and underground guides doing their best.
Exactly. But between 2006 and 2024, everything changed. We entered this era of highly controlled clinical trials. Researchers started using precise, synthesized psilocybin, I mean, mared down to the single milligram.
Wow.
Yeah, and administering it under perfectly standardized conditions. So for the first time in human history, we actually mapped the dose response landscape of the brain.
And here's where it gets really interesting for you listening, because usually when we think about taking a medication, say like an ibuprofen or a blood pressure pill, the logic is perfectly linear,
Right. You take a larger dose, you get a stronger physical effect.
a straight line. But the central thesis of this breakdown is that psilocybin is not a line. It's a matrix.
Matrix. Yeah.
The dose is the singular variable that changes absolutely everything about the experience. It shifts the effects qualitatively, not just quantitatively.
It's a completely different experience in different levels.
Exactly. But before we can even look at the map of those doses, we have to talk about what exactly researchers are measuring. Because, I mean, if we are studying the effects of magic mushrooms, why don't clinical trials just hand people a carefully weighed pile of dried
Oh,
mushrooms?
the translation problem. Yeah, the translation problem between the natural world and the clinical world is immense.
How so?
Well, converting the milligrams of synthetic psilocybin used in a laboratory to the grams of dried mushrooms you might find out in the real world. It's a wildly unpredictable game.
Because of the variance in the actual fungus.
Exactly. The most common species, Psilocybe cubensis, it can contain anywhere from 0.2% to 2% psilocybin by dry weight.
Wait, 0.2 to 2? That's a huge gap.
It's a massive variance, and
Gobble.
it depends on the specific strain, how the fungus was grown, the drying method used, even just how long it's been stored in a jar.
Okay, I want to make sure you listening really grasp the stakes of that variance because it's completely wild. It's a imagine ordering a pint of beer at a bar. But depending on the batch that day, the bartender might hand you a light, easy drinking lager or.
Or they hand you a pint of pure 100-proof grain alcohol.
Yes, and they look exactly the same in the glass. The bartender doesn't even know which one it is.
That's a great analogy. And that variance is exactly why clinical science had to switch to synthetic. You simply cannot run a rigorous, safe, scientific trial when the fundamental variable is just shifting beneath your feet.
Right, because you need reproducibility.
Exactly. Let's look at the actual math the researchers lay out just to illustrate your beer analogy. Let's say a person takes 3 grams of an average mushroom batch one that contains about 0.6% psilocybin. That is going to deliver roughly 18 milligrams of the active compound into their system.
Which is a pretty standard moderate dose,
Right?
right?
That sits very comfortably within clinical safety protocols. But if that same person takes 3 grams of a high potency strain, one that contains 1.5% psilocybin, they are suddenly delivering 45 milligrams straight to their brain.
45 milligrams.
Yeah. They have just blasted right past clinical safety protocols and into territory that carries a significantly higher risk of a deeply difficult or overwhelming psychological experience.
See, that completely shatters the golden rule you always see repeated everywhere online. You know, you see people confidently stating, oh, 3.5 grams of mushrooms is equal to about 30 milligrams of synthetic.
Yeah, you see that everywhere. And the research strongly stresses that that conversion is nothing more than a loose average. It should never be relied upon as a clinical guide.
So, molecularly speaking, is there any difference between the two?
No. Molecularly, the synthetic psilocybin used in these trials and the natural psilocybin found in the fungi are absolutely identical. Your body processes them the exact same way.
But the mushrooms have other stuff in them, right?
Yes. That's the complication. The whole mushroom contains other natural alkaloids, like biocystin.
Right.
And there's this hypothesized entourage effect where these other compounds might slightly shape or color the experience, kind of similar to how different cannabinoids work in marijuana.
Ah, okay.
But, and this is key, that remains biologically unproven for psilocybin. What is proven is that clinical trials require strict reproducibility, and synthetic provides that.
Okay, so now that we understand why synthetic precision is the only way to do the science, let's look at the actual map researchers have charted.
The five tiers.
Right. The data breaks human consciousness down into five distinct tiers of dosing, moving all the way from modern cultural folklore straight into clinical reality. So let's start at the bottom with tier one, the microdose.
Right.
This is 1 to 3 milligrams of synthetic psilocybin. The clinical texts define this as subperceptual. You aren't seeing geometric visuals on the walls, and you aren't having massive mood shifts.
No, you shouldn't feel high at all. Users frequently report improved focus, better emotional fluency, maybe less rumination on their daily problems.
But
connecting this to the bigger picture of clinical data yields some pretty sobering results. The Beckley Foundation ran a landmark self-blinded study in 2021 led by a researcher named Sigeti, looking specifically at microdosing.
And a self-blinded study means the participants set up their own pills, right? Like in identical capsules and envelopes, so they wouldn't know if they were taking the drug or a placebo on any given day.
Exactly. It's a very clever design. And they found that while people did report modest positive effects on their well-being over time.
Here comes the kicker.
The placebo group reported those exact same modest positive effects.
Okay, wait, hold on. I have to challenge that.
Sure.
You have thousands of tech executives, artists, creatives, I mean, people who swear their productivity and mental health doubled from microdosing. It is a massive cultural movement. Are you telling me all of these high performers are just falling for a massive placebo effect? How is that even possible?
I know it sounds crazy, but the Sigeti trial data heavily validates that it is, in fact, overwhelmingly a placebo effect. While thousands of users anecdotally report incredible benefits, no controlled clinical trial to date has proven its efficacy over a standard sugar pill.
Wow.
The placebo effect is incredibly powerful when it comes to human psychology. If you expect a pill to make you more focused and present, your brain often just does the work of making you more focused and present.
That's wild.
Yeah. The mechanism for a chemical benefit at that subperceptual level remains entirely unproven. Current clinical evidence just does not support using tier one doses for treating actual medical populations.
That is a massive paradigm shift for anyone casually following the trend. You hear about it constantly, but the hard science just isn't there yet.
Not yet, no.
Okay, moving up the ladder. Tier two is the low dose. This is 5 to 10 milligrams of synthetic. This is the perceptual threshold. You get mild euphoria, maybe colors seem a bit brighter, or sensory perception is enhanced, but the anxiety risk remains very low.
Exactly. The data notes this is a great stepping stone for a first exposure, but again, it isn't really used as a treatment in these landmark clinical trials either.
Because it's not strong enough.
Right. The therapeutic engine doesn't really roar to life until the next bracket. Tier 3 is the moderate dose. This sits between 15 and 25 milligrams of synthetic.
And this is the sweet spot, right?
Yes. This is widely considered the clinical gold standard. In this tier, which typically lasts about 4 to 6 hours, you see patients experiencing vivid closed-eye visuals, significant time distortion, and incredibly deep emotional processing.
And then pushing even further, we get into tier 4, the high dose. We're talking 30 to 40 milligrams.
This is totally immersive.
Right. You start seeing full ego dissolution for a substantial number of people. It demands a massive amount of support from the therapist in the room. But it's also where researchers at NYU and Hopkins have seen incredible results for patients dealing with the severe existential distress of a terminal illness.
It's truly life-changing for those patients. And then finally, we reach tier 5, the heroic dose.
The famous one.
Yeah. This is anything over 40 milligrams of synthetic. This is the equivalent of Terence McKenna's famous 5 dried grams in silent darkness. It induces a complete dissolution of the boundary between self and other.
But clinically speaking.
Clinically speaking, what is absolutely vital to understand here is that no modern clinical trials use doses at this level.
None.
None. The risk of profound psychological difficulty or panic is simply too high. It belongs entirely to ethnobotanical tradition, not to modern medicine. The undeniable therapeutic breakthroughs, the ones changing modern psychiatry, are happening almost exclusively in tiers 3 and 4.
So what does this actually look like for you inside your own body? Say you take a tier 3 dose like 25 milligrams. What is actually happening biologically to produce these wild effects? And how do doctors decide exactly how much of it to give you? Let's unpack the metabolism.
Sure. So once ingested, the psilocybin makes its way to the gut and the liver.
Mm-hmm.
There, an enzyme called alkaline phosphatase goes to work.
Alkaline phosphatase. Okay.
Right. It strips away a phosphate group from the psilocybin molecule in a process called dephosphorylation. This converts the psilocybin into a new chemical called psilocin.
So psilocin is what actually does the work.
Exactly. Psilocin is the active compound that crosses the blood-brain barrier and binds to your serotonin receptors.
Mm.
Plasma concentrations of psilocin peak at exactly 80 minutes on average.
80 minutes?
Yeah. And after that, the entire chemical process is cleared out of your system by your kidneys in about 4 to 6 hours. And crucially, extensive human trials show it has zero bodily toxicity and zero addiction potential.
Which is pretty amazing for something so powerful. But here is a truly fascinating pivot the research highlights regarding how they actually dose this. For a very long time, researchers were using weight-based dosing.
Right, like most medications.
Yeah. They used a specific formula of 0.3 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. So if you weighed 70 kilograms, you'd get about 21 milligrams. If you were heavier, you naturally got a higher dose.
Makes sense on paper.
It does. But the OOTW Journal details a massive revelation from a 2022 phase 2 trial led by a researcher named Goodwin. They completely abandoned body weight. They shifted entirely to fixed doses.
Yes.
Every single person in the trial got either a flat 1 milligram, a flat 10 milligrams, or a flat 25 milligrams. It didn't matter if you were a tiny 100-pound person or a massive 250-pound linebacker.
It seems highly counterintuitive at first glance, right?
Yeah.
Why abandon a personalized weight-based metric that we use for almost every other drug in medicine? But pharmacokinetic modeling revealed something surprising about how this specific compound breaks down. The variations caused by how fast your unique gut absorbs the compound and the specific rate of your liver's metabolism are massive.
So the gut is the deciding factor.
Completely. Those metabolic differences completely dwarf any subtle variations caused by your overall body weight.
Let me simplify that with an analogy because I really want you to be able to visualize what the researchers discovered here. Adjusting a dose based on someone's body weight is like trying to guess how fast a sponge will soak up a puddle of water by measuring how heavy the plastic bucket is that the sponge is sitting inside.
Oh, that's perfect.
Right. The bucket's weight doesn't matter at all. It is entirely about the unique porosity of the sponge itself. And in this case, the sponge is your gut's unique metabolism.
Exactly. And the fixed dose approach yielded incredibly clear data that backed up that exact logic. In that 2022 trial, they used a standard clinical scale to measure depression severity called the MADRS scale.
MADRS, right.
Yep. And the group that received the fixed 25 milligram dose outperformed the 10 milligram group by nearly 3 times.
3 times the effectiveness.
Yes. They saw a 6.6-point reduction in their depression scores compared to just a 2.5-point reduction for the 10 milligram group. It definitively proved that 25 to 30 milligrams is the minimum effective dose required to trigger robust antidepressant effects, regardless of the patient's size.
Okay, so we've established the chemistry. We know the psilocin peaks in the brain at 80 minutes, and we know exactly how many fixed milligrams are required.
Yeah.
But chemistry alone does not cure clinical depression.
No, it doesn't.
Right. So how does a fleeting chemical reaction in your gut and liver translate into a profound long-term psychological change? There has to be a missing puzzle piece here.
There is. And we return to the concept of the dose acting as a matrix rather than a linear track. At low doses, the primary mechanism seems to be an increase in neuroplasticity, the brain forming new neural connections. But when you move into those moderate and high doses, tiers 3 and 4, you cross a threshold. You aren't just forming new connections. You're experiencing massive phenomenological shifts.
Meaning your actual perception of reality changes.
Exactly. the rigid boundaries of who you believe you are begin to soften.
And the research points to a very specific mechanism for the actual healing here. It's not just chemical, it's experiential. It's called the mystical experience. And researchers can actually measure this, right? Using a clinical survey called the MEQ30, or the Mystical Experience Questionnaire.
That's right. It asks patients to rate their subjective feelings of awe, a sense of unity with their surroundings, and the loss of time and space.
And there was a landmark 2016 study by Griffiths that proved that hitting this specific threshold of a mystical experience, which usually happens around 20 to 30 milligrams, directly predicted whether a patient would have long-term positive outcomes 6 months later.
Yeah, the data is staggering.
In fact, 61% of people at the 30 milligram dose had a complete mystical experience, according to the survey.
And what is happening psychologically during that mystical experience is profound. It really explains why the healing lasts long after the chemical is gone. There's a temporary dissolution of what psychologists call the narrative self.
The narrative self. Let's unpack that.
So this is the ongoing rigid story you tell yourself every day about who you are, what your past trauma means, and what you are capable of achieving. For a depressed person, that narrative is often a dark, inescapable loop.
Just constantly repeating the same negative thoughts.
Exactly. But when that narrative self dissolves during a high dose, it creates a unique defense-free window. Patients can suddenly re-examine their core beliefs, their grief, and their deepest fears without their usual psychological armor getting in the way.
See, this is such a critical distinction for you to absorb. It sounds like the drug isn't actually fixing the brain the way, say, an antibiotic goes in and attacks a bacterial infection. The drug is merely inducing an experience, and it's the subjective experience itself that does the healing. And I guess that explains why researchers don't use those sub-threshold tier 1 or tier 2 doses for primary depression treatments. They simply don't trigger the experience.
You nailed it. The clinical data consistently shows that a patient's subjective score on that mystical experience questionnaire predicts their long-term healing outcome far more powerfully than the precise milligram amount of the chemical they ingested.
Wow.
Yeah. If a patient takes a high dose but resists the experience, like they don't cross the threshold into that sense of unity and awe, the therapeutic outcomes are significantly less robust.
So if the sheer intensity of the experience is the medicine, what happens if you have that profound ego-dissolving experience in the wrong environment?
Oh, that is a recipe for disaster.
Which brings us to the absolute most crucial rule of dosing science, something the researchers call set, setting, and integration.
Yes. And we must start with baseline biological safety, because no dose at any tier is appropriate for individuals with a personal or first-degree family history of schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or psychosis.
That's a hard boundary.
An absolute hard boundary. The specific way psilocin binds to the 5-HT2A serotonin receptors in the brain can trigger severe, lasting episodes in vulnerable people. Furthermore, it interacts dangerously with common antidepressants and mood stabilizers like MAOIs, lithium, and certain SSRIs. Combining these can cause a dangerous overload of serotonin. So that is the baseline of safety.
But even if you are biologically cleared, the environment dictates absolutely everything. The breakdown references a 2018 study by Johnson that coined the term the set and setting multiplier. And this blew my mind when I read it. 25 milligrams taken in an unsupported, anxious, or chaotic environment is quite literally a completely different pharmacological event than 25 milligrams taken in a safe, deeply supportive therapeutic container.
That multiplier effect is exactly why the famous Hopkins protocol is so incredibly rigorous. You know, you don't just walk into a clinic, take a pill, and read a magazine in the waiting room.
Right.
There are 6 to 8 hours of preparatory talk therapy over several weeks before you ever see the medicine. The dosing session itself is highly orchestrated. The patient lies on a comfortable couch, wears eye shades to block out the room, and listens to a specific instrumental music playlist designed to evoke emotion.
And they aren't alone, right?
Never. Two trained guides sit in the room with them for the entire 6 to 8 hours. And then there are multiple integration therapy sessions spread out over the following weeks.
Let's talk about those following weeks, actually, because clinical protocols force you to wait at least 2 weeks between sessions if you are taking a second dose. Why the delay? Because it isn't just about pharmacological tolerance, right? I mean, the body's tolerance to psilocybin peaks and resets in just 48 to 72 hours.
Right. The chemical is gone. The delay actually comes down to a theory proposed by researcher Robin Carhart-Harris in 2021 regarding neuroplasticity. The acute pharmacological effects of the trip might be completely gone in 6 hours, but the brain remains in a state of heightened neuroplasticity for days, sometimes weeks, after the session.
kind of like it's warm and moldable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's incredibly receptive to new learning, breaking old habits, and forming new associative patterns. That period is known as the integration window.
The integration window.
The prevailing hypothesis is that the acute trip just shakes up the snow globe. The real therapeutic work, the lasting psychological change, happens as the snow settles during that weeks-long integration window.
There is a quote from the OOTW journal text that summarizes this dynamic so perfectly, and I want you to burn this into your memory. It says, "Dose is the key. The container is the lock."
Oh, that's brilliant.
Isn't it? Taking 30 milligrams at a loud, chaotic music concert versus taking 30 milligrams on a couch with eye shades and a trained psychotherapist are entirely different medical interventions. The chemical key might be exactly the same, but the psychological lock it is turning is completely different.
It is a profound shift in how we view pharmacology. The precise dose is absolutely necessary, as the five clinical tiers prove. But without the container of preparation and integration, the dose alone is never sufficient.
So let's look at the incredible journey we've just taken on this deep dive. We started by mapping the wild, unpredictable variants of natural mushrooms and that beer analogy that shows why science absolutely demanded synthetic precision.
Right.
We navigated the five distinct clinical tiers of human consciousness, from the debunked hype of the microdose placebo up to the clinical gold standard of 25 milligrams. We discovered that your body weight doesn't matter a bit compared to your gut's metabolism. And we learned that the mystical experience, supported by an ironclad therapeutic container, is the true mechanism of healing.
It really reframes everything we thought we knew. And as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over on your own time.
Lay it on us.
Think about that integration window concept we just discussed. In traditional Western medicine, we are deeply, almost implicitly, conditioned to believe that taking a pill is the treatment. You take the pill does the work.
Like taking a Tylenol for a headache.
Exactly. But psilocybin challenges this entirely. If the true healing happens in the weeks after the dose, during that extended window of neuroplasticity, it means the medicine doesn't actually cure you at all. It merely unlocks a temporary door so that your own mind can step through and cure itself.
Wow.
So what other areas of our mental and physical health might completely transform if we focused a little less on the chemical key and a lot more on the psychological lock?